Jesus save.
Mormon Mental Health is a production of Mormon Stories Podcast and the Open Stories Foundation. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards supporting its listeners. To support the podcast, please consider a donation today at mormonmentalhealth.org. And thanks for listening.
Jordan Compass came from me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Mormon Mental Health. This is Natasha Helfer Parker, and today I am interviewing Becca Mark, who is an author of a new book which recently came out called Prose of Prozac, a faith-based memoir of overcoming the stigma. So she's here to discuss her book and the stigma surrounding mental illness. She was born in San Diego, California, currently lives in Orem, Utah, oldest of 14, married and parent of three children, one of them being stillborn, and I think she'll talk about that. She graduated from Brigham Young University with a bachelor's in psychology and has a master's degree in public administration. And she's an active LDS member and has started such ventures as a Mormon LDS postpartum support group, which we will link to, and also has a Prose of Prozac community online. So we will get a chance to talk to her and find out more about these projects that she's involved with. So hello, Becca. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being with us today. So I think I'd like to start with just a little bit of your story. I think that right off the bat, though, before we start on your story, I think we want to do the disclaimer that you're not
definitely
an advocate for, you talk about Prozac, but nobody's endorsing you to talk about Prozac. Is that correct? Do you want to say a little bit about that, and then we'll go into your story?
Yeah, I don't endorse a specific type of medication, or no one's paying me behind the scenes. I just am... I'm not even an expert on mental health or mental illness. I just am here to tell my personal story and how Prozac helped me. And that's where I come from.
That's right. And so along with that, we want to make sure that listeners take this story as a personal kind of memoir. And if you have any further questions about medication or what might be appropriate for you, to make sure you speak with your at least primary care physician, if not a psychiatrist or other mental health professional.
Yes.
Okay, so having said that, yeah, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, so you said I'm married to Matt Mark. He's a 6'7 basketball player, and I have two cute kids. And I am, one thing I'll talk about later is that I'm being the oldest of 14 children, and I have had family history of mental illness. So it's interesting when having 14 children within a family to see how that comes out. In my family, there are 7 girls and 7 boys, all from the same parents, all single births. And you may have seen my mother give birth, actually, naturally, on to one of my sisters in the movie Miracle of Birth.
It's
been shown, yeah, all over the United States at colleges and high schools. But yeah, I kept meeting more and more women or girls who were going through the same thing that I was going through after I had my first child. And so I thought, how could I put it out there, or put my story out there, just to let other people know they're not alone? So that's, I've just written the book, and I put it out there just barely, so...
Yeah, well, I think it takes a lot of courage to do what you did. I have read your book, and it's what I liked about it is that it's very short, it's very readable,
yeah.
It's very kind of to the point, and it shares your experiences. So you can download it on, I think, an email, not an email, whatever, like eKindle or those kinds of books as well. And but one of the things that you mentioned right at the beginning, I think before your first even chapter, was something upon the idea that, you know, that many will disagree with you, and you even called yourself a proverbial sacrificial lamb as far as putting your story out there. So I just wanted to get your take about what were you worried about in writing this story, and were you worried that you were going to offend certain people, or what was going on for you in that sense?
Yeah, with that, it seems like just because I want to say some positive things that have happened and have been facilitated in my life by Prozac, it seems that some people misconstrue that and think that maybe I'm against other types of things that can help, like exercise or any other things, nutrition and therapy, talk therapy, anything like that. And so every time I put the book out there or start talking about it, people automatically think, oh, you just think that's the one solution to everything. So I say, no, it's just, I don't think medication's the solution to anyone's, like the full solution to anyone's mental health. It's just works for me, and it works for millions of people, or helps people manage their mental illnesses. And with this book, it's, like you said, it's pretty simple. It's a really simple story. I just talk about, there's kind of three parts to the book. So the first part, I talk about me and my personal story, and I went from being a person who perpetuated the stigma that surrounds mental illness to now I understand, since I've been there, what mental illness can be like, or the postpartum depression or anxiety can be like. And then the second part of the book, I talk a lot about, from a Christian standpoint, talk about the stigma of mental illness. And then the third part is just a resource section. So this book is best for someone who's maybe new to the idea, or someone who feels alone and hasn't necessarily done a lot of research on the subject, so I have found in putting the book out there that there are some people that have really strong emotions that are incomplete. It's just completely opposite of the way I feel. And I find in approaching this subject, I just wanted to put it out there and say, hey, let's just talk about it. Let's talk about the elephant in the room, because there are some people that feel that don't want to talk about it. They just, if you're dealing with depression and anxiety, that somehow you're bad, or somehow there's an interesting stigma that I've encountered. So
sure. Well, and as a mental health professional myself, I totally agree with you that any treatment for depression should be multifaceted, right? So,
oh, definitely.
Including the possibility of meds or therapy or eating better or sleeping better. You know, there's probably, yeah, 50 different things we could be doing to help our depression if that's something that we're dealing with. At the same time, I do agree with you that there seems to be somewhat of a recent backlash for meds, and maybe some stories around pharmaceutical companies, just being in it for the buck, and therefore people kind of mistrust pharmaceuticals and the psychotropic medications that are out there. There seems to be a population that feels that way about meds, and that can be very verbal about how they express their opinions about those things. And so that makes it difficult.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
I definitely agree. I think there's a louder minority out there who's saying the natural way is better or whatnot. But there are millions of people that are being helped by these drugs to manage. And so it's just an interest. So I wanted to put something out there that's positive about it. And it doesn't mean there isn't negative just because I talk about the pros, but I just wanted to put something out there positive because it has helped me significantly and helped so many other people. So
yeah, in fact, you even talk about before quitting your job, you mentioned that you had spoken with your boss, or your boss had pulled you aside.
Yes.
And said,
yes,
to not go on meds because that was really a bad choice if you were going to do something like that. So she kind of clued you in to postpartum might be an issue, but to not count on meds as part of the solution.
Yeah, so she said if I was feeling depressed or anxious, there was a natural solution, and there was something that I wasn't doing right, or there was something I just needed to figure it out, and it was only weaklings, she used the term, that really went on the medication. So that's where I started from, but I didn't think before I had my first child that I would experience any of that. I just assumed I'd be fine. My mom has 10 kids, I mean 14 kids obviously, but every single one, she had a natural birth, it was easy for her. She got home and she's a voice teacher, and within 2 days she was teaching voice lessons again, and it was just easy. She never complained about the pregnancy, she never complained about, anything. And so after the fact, so when I approached having my child, I had no idea. no idea what could be coming for me. So,
yeah, and you, if I'm going to quote a phrase here, you said that part one was that you yourself perpetuated some of the stigmas, and you write in your book saying, I had always believed that if you're depressed, you're not doing something right. If you're anxious, you need more preparation. If you feel down, you need to recognize the blessings around you, express gratitude, and think optimistically. So what was I doing wrong?
Definitely. And so I thought that was how I should have approached the problem. So I started, and I thought, okay, so what am I doing wrong? I had gained quite a bit of weight with the pregnancy. So even months after having my baby, I had 40 pounds still to lose to be a healthy weight. And so I figured that was the problem. So I tried to fix it. I exercised, I ate far fewer calories, and within a year and a half, I lost the weight, but I still felt out of control, depressed, hopeless, overly anxious. So I thought, okay, I mean, just all along the way, I kept trying to think, I mean, why am I feeling this way? Because I logically knew my life was great. It really was. But I knew, but I didn't feel that way. And I thought maybe it's because our finances weren't in order. And so I put them all in order. We, like, even moved to a house half the size and one-third the cost. And my husband got a new job. We lived frugally, paid off all our debt. And I still, after it was this one-and-a-half-year time period, still at the end I felt depressed and anxious. And then you talked about how I worked before I had my child. And before, I thought, that because I chose to stay home with my child and I left work and I quit my job, that I thought maybe my sense of worth is just wrapped up in the professional world, and like maybe my self-worth was related to the amount of money I earned. And but I knew I wanted to be the one to stay home with my child. So I tried to resolve everything. And even in the book, I go through a long list of questions. And I'm like, am I sleeping enough? Am I drinking enough water? Am I lacking a vitamin in my diet? Am I eating too much sugar? Am I spending enough time in the sun? Am I intimate enough with my husband? Am I spending enough time with friends? Am I spending enough time alone? Am I setting proper boundaries in all my relationships? And I go on. And then I go into even from a religious standpoint, we know the scripture, and wickedness never was happiness. So I thought, okay, I must really be doing something wrong. So am I developing my God-given talents? Which of the Ten Commandments am I not following? Am I serving others enough? Maybe it's just that I need to write in my journal. Am I praying enough? And as you can see, I'm a goal-oriented person. I'll just set a goal and I'll just do it. And I'm sure have to find a solution to it. I can't live my life this way. So, but maybe then I thought, maybe I'm too goal-oriented and I just needed to relax. But after every single thing, I would find a solution. I mean, I didn't become a perfect human being at the time, but I really found a solution to everything, and I still felt this depression and anxiety that was overwhelming. Like, I couldn't leave the house. I couldn't do anything. And I didn't know what was going on, but I knew I could do it on my own. I didn't need help. But I did. I needed help. So.
Well, I think one of the things that's very interesting about what you just stated is how it all came back to self-responsibility over something that you were experiencing that was medically wrong with you. You know, and so there was, and I think yes. You make this connection to, or not connection, but parallel to diabetes.
Yes.
Whereas, you know, if you have diabetes or if you have a broken leg and you're wearing a cast, those are physical ailments that we're all pretty comfortable understanding that there's a medical solution to those problems. And we don't necessarily self-blame, although even with type 2 diabetes, we might self-blame somewhat because sometimes that's connected to bad diet or, you know, gaining weight.
Definitely.
Or things like that. But at the same time, there's a medical solution to that. Whereas mm-hmm. I think with depression, what you're pointing out is that it's difficult to understand that there's a medical reason oftentimes attributed to that. And therefore we're just finding all these things. There must be something wrong with me. Right. And so we go into this kind of self-shame cycle.
Yeah. I just thought that I am just must be worthless. I just didn't know. Yeah, I must have been doing something wrong. But I love, yes, I talk about that type 2 diabetes in my book too, because even if someone has put themselves in a situation where they would have diabetes, like becoming overweight or just not being healthy, that you still need, in that case, medication to get back to where to manage your life until you can. And sometimes if you lose the weight, then you are not diabetic anymore. So I found, yeah, I just made this parallel. I thought, wow, even if someone has made choices that have put themselves into a depressive state, or I mean clinical depression and anxiety, if or any mental disorder, they still need help. It's not that we just blame them and say, I mean, you don't get, I don't know, you still need help. And also with this, I go and I talk about, in that same chapter, I talk about, because in general, doing everything we can to be self-reliant, I believe, is a good thing. We should never trouble ourselves for anything that we can, we should never trouble another for something we can successfully do ourselves. So, but then on the flip side, I talk a lot about how it's human error to reject help when we actually need it. So I was not, in doing what I was doing and trying to fix myself, I was still in error because I was rejecting help when I needed it. Right, all around me, there were these resources, and I just thought, I mean, for some strange reason, I just thought I could do it on my own. And sometimes you can, but with this case, I couldn't. There was nothing I could have done. And the more I talk to women, I just find the more and more people are the same way. They say, well, I know I need help, so I'm going to do all these other things, but I just won't go on the medication. Or it's like they're open and willing to do anything, except for once you take that medication, then I guess you have to admit that you have a real problem, and that's hard to do. So,
yeah, and I think that one of the things that you described really well, once you did go on the medication, is that it's kind of like you were sowing what you reaped, or reaped what you sowed. I always mess it up.
Yeah.
I'm obviously not a farmer, but yeah. Anyway, so basically, in other words, if you maybe have mild depression or even just the day-to-day ups and downs, and you're exercising well and you're, you know, taking care of yourself and boundaries and all these things that, you know, you went through that huge list, you are going to see a benefit to your life. You know, you're going to see an increase to your quality of life.
Yes.
And yet you were doing those things and you were not seeing an increase. And so that was a good clue into the sense of whether or not medication might be useful, because you were making those lifestyle changes and yet not finding much of an impact on your depression at all. Is that correct?
Yes. And so now I find myself a person, an after Prozac person, I mean a currently on Prozac person, or fluoxetine, the generic is what I take. And then I find myself, now if I choose something that's good for me, I feel good. If I choose something that's bad for me, I feel bad or feel guilt. Now it seems like everything's realigned, and which has just been a miracle. Knowing where I was, now I'm just so grateful to be where I am. Because I could not have come here. I don't think there's anything else I could have done except for take the medication. So, and also,
go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, and with that, then in the book I also talk about, but still living my life going forward, I'm not just fine because I take a drug. I'm not like just, it's not a cure-all or a solve-all to my life. Like, no matter, I talk about, in that second part of the book, I talk about with the stigma, but I also talk about how no matter how many pills I take, if I'm not aligning my life with these principles of truth and happiness, I will never be happy, or I will never feel lasting joy and peace. And so then I talk about a holistic way of approaching. So it's really the combination, like, I mean, it's multifaceted, but without that drug, without the medication, I could never have come to a spot where I could function, even to where I could continue to improve. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's how I.
Yeah, and you do a really good job in the book of kind of pointing that whole process out. And with our pioneer heritage, I often do the metaphor of the of a pioneer cart, you know, going along the road, and all of a sudden you're in a rut and you just can't get it out, and the whole wagon team comes, you know, and starts pushing you out of that rut, and sometimes you just need that extra boost, and in a sense that's how I relate the medication, because you still have to walk the journey, you still have to put the effort in, you know, you still need to, like you said, do other things to make your life move forward. The medication isn't going to magically get you to Salt Lake City, right?
On,
on a magic carpet.
No, it's not. Yeah.
But you need that extra. Otherwise, you're just stuck in that rut and you're never going to get anywhere, even though you're pushing with all your might, you know, against that wheel. You just, you need that extra muscle.
That's an excellent enough
to get you going, right?
That's exactly how it is. Yeah.
Well, let's back up a little bit and tell me a little bit about what depression and anxiety were like for you. Because this is, you know, let's get into the symptoms and what your experience was. Because I know you say that you had more of a postpartum experience. But then also when you went on the Prozac, you realized that maybe it was something you were even dealing with prior to having your children. So just walk me through, because I think everybody's depression story is a little bit different, and I think it's useful to hear that.
Yeah, I haven't found anyone where it's the same. We have a lot of similarities, I think, amongst us with depression and anxiety, but it's, yeah, definitely unique. So with me, I didn't feel any despair or this deep hopelessness until about 3 months after I had my baby. I stopped breastfeeding, and after I stopped nursing, I just, the simple things would throw me into this deep despair. The first time I felt these deep emotions, and I just we were selling a house we had at the time, like a duplex that we owned, and I put it on the market, and then within a couple days, we had an offer, but then the offer fell through, so I just had received the phone call about the offer falling through, and I sat, and after I hung up, I sat down on the couch, and I thought my life, I knew it wasn't over, but I felt like my life was over, like there was no hope for me and my situation, and I think back that no, that an offer falling through, that's a sad thing. Yes, I mean, anyone would be disappointed, but the feelings I felt, they're really hard to even put into words. It's just, they were just so deep and just completely paralyzed me. And then I found, as I kept going through just doing anything, like I would play, Matt and I were playing Yahtzee one evening, and I just had a streak of losses. I mean, I just kept losing. And every round, I would just get worse and worse and worse, and I just had to stop playing the game. I couldn't even do something simple as just play a Yahtzee game, because it would send me into this deep, deep, I mean, just hopelessness. And then on top of that, I just felt so anxious because I couldn't control how I was feeling. It was very strange. So then I go on the, so after the 15 months of not getting help, then I finally got help. And after I went on Prozac, I realized, looking back, that I had suffered, I am sure, my whole life with, albeit not as severe, my whole life with anxiety and depression. And I didn't know. I didn't know because it was just normal for me. Day to day, I talk a lot about, okay, in graduate school, one of my classes, they required me to ask another person about, or ask others about my strengths and weaknesses. So I go out, I found a former roommate, and I just asked her to be really honest in the survey. And in her critique, she described me as being someone who was always crying for one reason or another. And she didn't understand why, because my life seemed to be going well. And during that time, I actually thought that I was an upbeat person. But she was right. I would cry. I was completely unaware until after the Prozac of how emotionally unstable I was beforehand. I mean, and it's not a bad thing to cry. I'm not saying that someone shouldn't cry, but at some point we all need some release for these emotions that we have. But at the time, I would cry over everything. I mean, I cried driving in the car listening to songs on the radio. I cried alone in my room as if like all my hopes and dreams were coming to an end. I cried over boyfriends even if we weren't breaking up. And I didn't even cry when I was sad. I cried just to show sincerity for all aspects of life. And I just cried, how I cried was overkill. It was just all of the time. And I didn't realize at the time. I thought I was just being this sincere person. I didn't think I was even emotional, but after the fact, I mean, it just shows how bad it really got after the postpartum, after I had my first child, because it was so bad, then I actually realized that I had a problem, where before I was just living. Yeah, and I go through in the book, and I talk about, and maybe that's something I could do, like this before Prozac, I list some, these were six ways, or six things that, how I was. So no matter what I did, I felt depressed and anxious. The second one, my pet peeves, and I have quite a few, a need for order overran my life. And that was my whole life, I was that way, not just after the baby. And I always had this woe is me mentality. I cried over everything like I talked about, and seemed like my circumstances always controlled me. And then even in addition, I never consistently woke up on time. I was just a little off my whole life. I wasn't confident enough. I went up once to talk to a teacher in junior high, and I walk up to the teacher and I open my mouth and nothing can come out. I was so afraid to talk to her, so anxious, that I couldn't even ask her a simple question. It was just simple about what are we doing in the library or something like that. And I found myself before the Prozac, my life was always full of plans and lists, but I was always falling short. But after Prozac, it was just dramatic for me, and my emotions aligned with my actions, and now I feel like I can choose happiness and peace if that's what I want for myself. I have much more patience for others, and now that I've gone through this, I have much greater love and acceptance for others, because now I understand that most of us are really just doing the best that we can. I feel now like I have emotional stability. I wake up in the morning much easier. I use my time more wisely. I have a lot more confidence. I feel like now if I choose to, I can be my best self. But it was like before the Prozac, I was incapable of even coming to a point to even think that I needed to change some of those things.
A lot of your symptoms had to do with, you said emotional regulation. Also kind of, I think you mentioned foggy brain was mm-hmm. how you described it. So inability to maybe concentrate or make decisions. Mm-hmm. Of course, anxiety was part of the equation, which oftentimes depression and anxiety go hand in hand. That's pretty common for people to have anxiety attached to depression. Anything you want to add to that? Like, were there ever suicidal ideation or?
I will say before the baby, I had my whole life, I've had much more problems, although I was a crier all the time and sad and woe is me, but my anxiety my whole life has been the problem. And maybe because I haven't had skills to deal with it. But after, I will talk about one time, after my first child, he was Brady, my firstborn. After him, the depression never got to a point. I always still had this logic in my mind saying, and I could divide. I could say, I know my life is great, even though I don't feel that way. So I'm not going to act on these feelings. This is just irrational, these things I'm feeling and thinking. I'm just not going to act on this. But with my second child, who ended up stillborn, but with my second, my doctor thought I should come off of Prozac so it would be safer for the fetus. And so I came off of it, and then she put me on Zoloft instead. Or first we tried Celexa, and that did not work. So I came coming off of Prozac that's the only time I really in my life have felt these suicidal tendencies. So Celexa didn't work, so I went back to my doctor, and Zoloft, we tried that, and that didn't work. And I just got to where I was sleeping day and night. I couldn't do anything. I thought, I could not handle how my life was, and I thought maybe the only solution is to move on. But I never made plans for it. I never got to that point because I called my doctor one day and I said, I need Prozac. I have to have it. And for some people, Prozac is the wrong drug for them. I mean, someone can say, I've met a lot of people where Zoloft is their ideal drug, or Celexa worked really well for them. But for me, Zoloft, Celexa, and any other drugs we tried, it did not work. So I called my doctor and I said, I do not care if my baby dies. I need Prozac. I can't function without it. So I will back on it, and within 5 weeks, I was just fine. completely fine again. So it was just pregnancy, really interesting. Yeah.
This was during your pregnancy?
Yes.
I didn't tell the rest of that story as far as what ended up happening.
Okay, so then I'm on, so I go back on Prozac, and right after I learn that my baby has died in my womb, so I say, yeah, it was stillborn. So when I was about 24 and a half weeks, the baby died. And so I delivered the baby, and after that, I felt like, I mean, that's a really awful thing to go through, but I felt like because of the Prozac, or because I had that additional help, I was able to cope much, much easier than I would have, I know, than I would have without it, knowing how I was when I came off of it. But as I go through, but one thing I want to point out here is, with the Prozac, it, for me, it just seems to realign things. So it doesn't mean I don't feel sadness anymore. It doesn't mean I... So with the baby that I lost, I still felt sad. I still went through this mourning process. And in the book, I talk about the five stages of this mourning that I went through, the denial and the... all the way to acceptance. And through each stage, I still, even with this drug, it didn't mean I no longer felt emotion. It didn't mean I no longer could... I mean, I wasn't just fine that my baby died. I really went through the stages, and I mean, you can read all about it. I mean, I felt the anger. I felt the depression. I mean, I would sob at nights in bed as my reserve broke down, because when I was exhausted, it would usually be late at night or when I was extra tired when I would break down. But I still went through everything, but I could handle it. And I'll read maybe one part. Even though... Looking back, had I not been on Prozac by the time I lost Wyatt, I believe I wouldn't have handled his death as well as I did. On Prozac, I felt the deep sadness that came with the loss, but still kept a rational mindset and always saw the situation for what it was, a blessing in disguise. And knowing how I'd normally handled things before Prozac, I know I wouldn't have transitioned as healthily through each stage of loss without it. Because a healthy mind always maintains hope, and I don't believe I would have kept that hopeful mindset, especially with how I was feeling suicidal right before I lost the child. I mean, right before I went on Prozac, which is before I lost the child.
Just to clarify, yeah. Just to make sure that we're clear, the baby dying had nothing to do with you being nope. on psychotropic meds, correct?
Nothing to do with that. It was... They think it was actually a chromosomal, he had an extra chromosome. So, and then also it was combined with the cord had been wrapped around his neck 8 times and around the shoulder multiple times. So it was all nothing related. And I talk a lot about that in my book too, because my doctor wanted me to come off Prozac when really, as I found out after, it's recommended that a pregnant woman should not be taken off necessarily off her medication. But you have to deal with your doctor about that and decide what's best for you. But for me, it was the wrong thing to come off right in the middle of a pregnancy. And it's just lucky, I think, that I got back on before I lost the child.
And this is an important thing to talk to your OBGYN and, yes. and hopefully also a psychiatrist about, because there are medications that have been deemed, you know, quote unquote, safe during pregnancy. And I think one thing that you also point out in the book, which is very important, is that depression in and of itself has negative effects on
yes.
pregnancy. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, let me find. So with, yeah, I mean, you have, okay, so you have someone with depression and who's pregnant. Going through, there is a risk with every medication. That's just the way it is. No matter what medication you're taking, it's a risk. But with, I'm flipping through, trying to find. Okay, so Prozac is what's considered a pregnancy class C drug. So this means animal studies have shown an adverse effect, but there are no adequate and well-controlled studies of pregnant women showing this drug demonstrates a risk to the fetus in any trimester. But if you think about, so we have this mother who it is a risk to go on the drug, but on the somber flip side, well, on is depression left untreated during pregnancy has been proven to lead to poor birth outcomes, including low birth weight, preterm delivery, lower Apgar scores, poor prenatal care, failure to recognize or report signs of labor, an increased risk of fetal abuse, neonaticide, or maternal suicide. So we have this risk of a medication, and it always has to be weighed against the mother and the health of the mother. But we have this medication, or it was like specifically with Prozac, who it has not, there has not been one study that shows that the drug demonstrates a risk to the fetus in any trimester, yet my doctor still took me off the drug when I was one of those people that on the somber flip side, it was not a good thing for me to come off the drug. It would have, had I stayed off, I think it would have been catastrophic. And then moving on to a third pregnancy, so then after Wyatt, I had a daughter, and she's only 10 months old now. But when I started with that pregnancy, because I had had the health issues with that, with Wyatt, they had me go to a specialist where I would have ultrasounds every few weeks to make sure the baby was okay with Scarlett. And so I would go, and they said, I mean, really, they, knowing my situation, I had one doctor talk to me about the Prozac, and she said that based on recommendations from the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, they consistently do not take pregnant women off of Prozac. And in the opinion of many healthcare professionals, the risks, like I talked about, risks of taking a woman off Prozac are much greater than leaving her on the drug, or not just Prozac specifically, but any type of psychotropic medication. And the reason I talk about this in my book is I'm not saying you have to stay on a drug when you're pregnant. I am for an individual taking complete responsibility for their life, and I found myself beforehand not knowing, not being educated about these things, not knowing even that postpartum depression could happen to me. And so I couldn't take necessarily what the doctors were telling me and make an educated decision. So this is why I've written the book, so people, just to put it out there and say, you need to take responsibility for your life and get help if you need help, and make sure you know about these things.
I agree. It's very difficult to, I mean, on the one hand, as mothers, you know, we can self-guilt over anything. it's very easy to do that, because I think we come from this place of deep intention for, you know, for the best for our children. So yes. I want to make clear that anything that we're sharing is not meant to further anyone's guilt who's maybe made decisions that are different than these.
No.
But it is mainly an effort to educate and to say, look, there are many options, and medication is one of those options that can be very useful. And, you know, and even for those who may be listening, who maybe should have been on medication and chose not to for whatever reason, and maybe now are, I want to reach out and just say, you know, don't beat yourself up over that. It's a process for all of us to, you know, self-educate. And we don't do, I think, a very good job either in the church or in society as a whole, educating women about these things in a way that's really comprehensive and in a way that people are able to trust. And so it's not,
yes.
I don't want any one woman to take full responsibility for choices they may or may not have made. Right. In this,
definitely. And that's why with the book, it's not just, okay, let me just talk about me. It's a book that it talks about my experience, but then goes on and talks about, okay, within our LDS culture or within a Christian culture, what are we dealing with, and why? What's keeping us from this? I mean, from getting help when we need it. And then it goes, and then, of course, like I talked about before, it just gives you some resources. So the back of my book is full of statistics and additional information and resources, places you can go for help. And we can only go forward. Looking back, I made a lot of mistakes, which I outline in the book. But the only thing I can control now is the future. So if in the past you haven't done what's best for you, it's not, you can still change now. So,
well, and I want to just piggyback what you said about issues during pregnancy with depression also continue once the baby is born. And so if you have a depressed mom trying to raise an infant, which generally that's very difficult to do when you're depressed. And
yes.
It's always amazing to me how women can push forward in those types of situations, as many do. And there's this fear, again, of taking meds because many of them choose to breastfeed because, again, with the
yes.
intention of giving the child the best, you know, and breast milk at this point of our time in this culture, we see that as the best choice for a baby.
Yes.
And so that often becomes a very difficult choice for women because they feel, well, I can't take something during breastfeeding. So again, you can take mm-hmm. medication during breastfeeding. And if you choose to not want to take that risk, I often tell mothers that I think it's more of a risk to have a depressed mother than it is a pro to have breast milk. So I would rather you be on, you know, good medication and getting treatment for depression and your baby on formula than to have a depressed mother, because there's attachment issues that can happen, and also the infant and children can pick up on depressive types of ways of dealing with life from a very early age, you know. So there's just,
yes.
again, there's just a lot of things to think about and a lot of choices that are very difficult for these mothers to make at a time that's already, I think, exacerbated
yes.
with, you know, anxiety.
Yeah, even if
and
so heavy depression, anxiety, it is like, it's this constant, the second the baby came out of me, I feel this, I forgave my mother for everything the second the baby popped out, because they said, oh, I get it, I get why, I get, she just did the best she could do. I really, the second my baby popped out, I felt this guilt, like I've ruined him forever, even just in the first minute. So it's, yeah, my whole idea with the book is not to make anyone feel more guilty than they already are. It's just to say, hey, there's something else that could help. And I want to kind of open it up, because it's something that I've seen it only talked about in these small groups of women. It's not, I mean, our generation is definitely more open than the past. And I talk about my family and family history. But it's still something that, it's okay to get help, and there are a lot of options. And I'm seeing a lot of women that I meet say, "I'll do anything except the medication." And with the breastfeeding too, with my last baby, with just my most recent, I stopped breastfeeding at 5 weeks because it really, the best thing for the baby was to have me with on Prozac, and not, and which was would have been okay with her, but I just saw different effects with her that I didn't want her to have. From the drug. But me healthy, it just came down to me healthy is worth a lot more. I'm a much better mom with the drug.
So that's a good thing to point out. So let's go back to the first time that you decided to go on Prozac, because I think there were some important steps that you had to take as you faced this big fear to even go to a doctor and talk about this for the first time. So why don't you talk a little bit about what that was like?
So right before I was willing to even go to a doctor, I hit what I describe like as a rock bottom for me. And I was driving up to go on a vacation when I should be excited and happy. And I just was sitting in the car and I said, logically, I know my life is great. It really is. But why do I feel the opposite? And I just felt like my life was falling apart. I was a failure. And my mind would just spin. And the more I tried to help myself, the more it would spin. So I finally got to this point where I could call the doctor. I was just so afraid. And I just, looking back, I don't know. I say, why didn't I call my midwife earlier? What was the big deal? But at the time, I was just paralyzed by this fear. I feared letting anyone know that I needed help. I hadn't let anyone know what I was suffering. I wasn't even completely open with my husband. I was afraid that even discussing more than surface feelings of being a new mom would take me across the line of stigma that I talk about, and from which I can never return, because once I said I had depression and anxiety, I was that kind of person. So I finally had this appointment, and I go to the appointment. Before the appointment, I was just afraid that my midwife would not believe me, because that's who I saw at the time was a midwife. And I just thought I was isolated. I thought I was alone, because I didn't talk to anyone about it. I thought I was the only one going through this. And I didn't think really that anything could help me. The only hope I felt that I had left was this medical route. So I went to my midwife, and I remember sitting in the office waiting for her, and the minutes that passed felt much, much longer. And I just, once she came in, I just boldly told her what was happening for 15 months, and I knew, and I told her I tried so many other things, and then I just asked, is there a drug that maybe could help me? And then she went through and, I mean, asked me about my family history, and we talked about the psychotropic drugs and solution and how one may work for me, but one works for one person and may not for me for another. But after that, I got the prescription. So I still, even after getting the prescription, it took me weeks. It took me a few days, actually, just to get it filled at a pharmacy. And I didn't go to a pharmacy nearby in my house because I didn't want someone seeing me getting the drug. And I knew I should get the prescription filled. I had it in my purse. I mean, everywhere I went, I had it in there. So finally, when I was about an hour from my house, it was on a completely unrelated errand, I stopped at a random pharmacy, and I went in, and I was even afraid at the time that the pharmacist who was helping me looked at me and thought less of me because I needed Prozac. So then now, okay, so I finally get the drug or medication, and with the pills in my possession, I was still hesitant. I remember I went back to where my husband was, and I just sat there, and I just had it in my hand, and I thought, do I take it, do I not? Because once I swallow it, it just mattered so much to me that once I swallowed it, I could never again say that I hadn't taken drugs for depression or anxiety. And I would be one of those people. And back then, I really perpetuated the stigma. I thought, I mean, I was just this gung-ho person. And I thought, oh, they just must not have enough willpower. Someone with depression or anxiety is just not doing something right. But I finally took the pill. I mean, I finally swallowed it. And I was just surprised. I was so fearful before, which may have been, I'm sure, was exacerbated by the depression and anxiety, but I was just had this, it was an irrational fear before. So I take the Prozac, and within the first 24 hours, I had minimal side effects. I just had diarrhea. Within the first few days, I was occasionally catatonic. I would just sit for periods of time and just look off into the distance and just wonder, but I just wondered if it was more me thinking about what I was doing. But then even in the first few months, the worst that I've had is a dry mouth, which now may be a side effect, but I don't notice it. But it was just this fear, and it was just little steps. And looking back, I wish as soon as I had felt this deep depression that was just not rational and it was unfounded, I mean, not connected to anything that would have warranted that deep emotion, I just looking back wish I would have gotten help right away for it. And that getting help is different for everyone, but for me at the time, I just wish I would have explored all my options at the time rather than waiting and putting my child at risk because I wouldn't admit that I had a problem.
And I think you make a good point that we need to probably point out that, and you've mentioned it several times now, that different people respond to different meds,
really?
Of course, differently. And you were lucky enough that the first type you tried was very effective, and you felt that effectiveness, I think, within, you said, the first 5 weeks. And then you go on to state that even after 6 months, there was another burst of effectiveness.
Yes.
So there was two significant periods of finding a difference in your life. I think what makes going on an antidepressant or anti-anxiety medicine very difficult for many people is that oftentimes they don't experience what you've shared. And so to have to wait 5 weeks, to go on something else, and then wait another 5 weeks, or 8 weeks to go on something else, oftentimes people just give up.
It's dreadful. And I feel very fortunate that the first one I tried was really effective. And I see other people who have not had the same experience. And even I have had a brother who, because genetically we thought Prozac would help him because he was having even though it's a boy and not having a baby, he was having depression and anxiety issues. And so he went on Prozac as well, thinking that if it worked for me, maybe it will work for a brother. And it was just awful for him. He had almost like concussion-like symptoms. He had all these, he had blackouts. It was just strange. But he ends up finding out that he's actually has bipolar. He has bipolar disorder or manic depressive. And so then a different drug is a much better solution for him. And with, so you talked originally when you introduced me about a community online. I am online trying to develop these communities of support. And because everyone, I say all the time, I mean, someone, like the combination of treatment for an individual can be as unique as that person is. But also, with saying the pros of Prozac, I've developed this pro, like dividing the pro, P, R, and O, and someone, when you approach mental health, this with the P, you have to be persistent, and you have to commit to saying, even if the first drug I try is not it, I'm going to keep going, not that it's always going to be a medicinal solution. Keep going and going and going and never, ever give up. You have to keep trying and trying until you get to that point. And it is really awful for some people. I mean, it's weeks and weeks of suffering. But in time, there are a lot of people that have found solutions, have found the healing, or found a significant way to manage, I mean, a successful way to manage their any mental illness that they're dealing with. So I'm just for, like with that pro, and I talk about this a lot online, like the persistence. You have to be mentally healthy, you have to be persistent, and then you have to be responsible. You have to, no matter how you're feeling as you're going through these ups and downs of the medication, whether it works for you or not, you have to avoid acting on anything that would be not in your best interest or not in someone else's. I mean, you have to, no matter what you think or feel, it doesn't mean you have to act on it. And then after you've found a solution, it's so important to be open with others. So the PRNO, persistence, responsibility, and then being open. You have to be open because there are so many, my story, there are a lot of people that have a similar story to mine. And if the more of us that are open, the more of us, you know, we can acknowledge a problem, then we can solve it. And the more of us that come together, we can figure out what works best. And you can see new ways that can help you.
Yeah, and I often talk with clients about, you know, a primary care physician is probably a good place to start, especially if you have mild to moderate depression. But oftentimes, you know, primary care physicians are, you know, will give you kind of the basic antidepressant with the basic dose. And if you have more either treatment-resistant depression or more severe depression, it can really be useful to see a psychiatrist who is much more, qualified to either give you a mixture of medicine or, you know, dose you at a level higher than maybe a primary care physician would be comfortable dosing you at. And, you know, taking your family history or seeing how you respond to certain medications, are going to be more qualified to see, okay, this family of medicine isn't working, so let's try, you know, a whole different family. And so it's really important to have the right resources as far as who your team is, right, that's helping you.
Oh, definitely. And that takes us kind of back to the stigma where we talked about even the diabetes. It is easier to approach, I think, a doctor about some of these issues than a psychiatrist, because once you go to the psychiatrist, then you're saying that you may have an issue that beyond like a mental issue to see a psychiatrist. But that, it is proven. I mean, medication with talk therapy or with therapy of other sorts is so much better for you. And seeing experts, the doctors don't necessarily, know all the, they're just not always the best. It's good to have, and all throughout my book I say, you have to find a healthcare provider and a mental health professional who can help you. You have to. And I'm lucky. My dad actually has a PhD in marriage and family therapy. So I've had, even within my family, this something that's been very helpful for me. So, and with therapy, I think of it, I don't, with there's stigma around the therapy too, because once you go to therapy, then you're admitting you have a problem. But I look at therapy as there's not one person on the earth, I don't think, that couldn't benefit from visiting a therapist, a competent therapist, or and going through some and changing negative, yeah, or destructive thoughts and behaviors that we have. Yeah, there's just so much out there. I just want to encourage people to get help who need it.
Right. Yeah, no, I appreciate you mentioning all that. I think that, and I think that you had a different experience, for example, with your midwife versus a psychiatrist you went to later on, correct, in your treatment approach.
Yeah, even with a midwife versus an OBGYN. So my midwife wanted to take a more natural route, and for me, that wasn't the best thing. So I took responsibility and I said, okay, maybe a different healthcare provider was better for me. So then I go into an OBGYN who had 40 years of experience and dealt with it all the time. And I had a much better experience with a different doctor. So if it's not working for you, you need to find someone else. And I just know if we keep working on a solution that we really can. Many, many people have come to a place where they can manage depression and manage anxiety if you don't give up before that point.
I just want to clarify too that I've known midwives who are very pro-medicine and midwives
definitely
who are not. And doctors who do a really great job and doctors who are, you know, who don't.
Yes,
so just
yes.
Like in any profession, right, there's going to be good providers, there's going to be also a personality quotient, I think, that makes a difference whether or not you click or you connect with somebody. And so I often tell people, even who are seeing me, just stay with me because you're the first person, or I'm the first person you're seeing, right? Make sure you're comfortable with me. Make sure that we're a good fit. Make sure that what I'm saying makes sense to you. And I think that that's a good approach to any type of professional that you're thinking of including in your team approach of resources.
Most definitely. You have to be willing to go to the next person if it's not working for you.
So going back to the symptoms off the medication, I do know that there are a lot of side effects that people can experience from being on, of course, any medicine. And again, I think, like you said earlier, you have to kind of weigh the pros and cons. But I do try to tell people that the goal is not to, like you very well stated, not to feel or not to have any feelings.
Oh, definitely not.
Depression and anxiety are normal feelings, and we all need to feel them at certain times of our life. In fact, they're
helpful.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like you said, you know, if your son dies and you're, you know, you're 25 weeks, you're supposed to feel sad, right? You're supposed to have, anxiety can be often a clue to help you know that you need to change course. It's just when these feelings become overriding, and like you said, when the content doesn't match the process, right? So in other words, the content is you playing Yahtzee, and the process is you're acting like, you know, you're having a major
it was
disaster in your life.
Like my husband died.
Right.
I was playing a simple dice game. It just did not make sense. And I knew it didn't make sense, but yes, I think you're right on.
Right. So you have to make sure things match, and also that they don't stay that way for too long. In other words, if you're sad because you just lost your job, that's normal. But if you're sad, you know, and still feeling pretty helpless and paralyzed 8 months later, then even though it's a normal reason to be upset and have difficulty, you might need some help during that situation to get you, you know, functional again. So those are things I think that quality or quantity of feeling is one clue to know whether or not things are out of sorts. And also the quantity of time that you've been feeling these things. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about your family history. You've mentioned several times that's an issue in your family. And how did you always know that? Did that kind of come to light with maybe some of your experiences? Or how was that dealt with in your family?
Yeah, the only thing I knew out of my whole entire family was that my mom's dad had dealt with, I mean, he was not, Yeah, no one really even talked about it. So I never knew what was going on. I just knew that he needed to go for a few weeks every once in a while or every few years up to the psych, up to a hospital to get electroshock therapy. So at least my mother did tell me that he was getting electroshock therapy but the only reason I think I even learned about my grandpa was because it really became so life-altering for our family, because he'd have to go for weeks at a time, and we were really close to him. And then we would go visit at the hospital, so my mom did prepare us and say, even, okay, we're going to visit him at the hospital. When you see him a few weeks from now, he's not going to remember that you came to visit and things like that. But that's all that I ever knew about my family. Nothing more. It's just, and my mom, it was like a protection. She wanted, I talk about in my book how one time I have a cousin who committed suicide amidst this battle with illicit drugs, and I was in college at the time, so I heard about it through my cousins, and so I went to the funeral. But when I got there, half of my family wasn't there, the youngest half, because my mom didn't want anyone knowing about the suicide or knowing, he didn't want to give any of the younger kids any ideas. So in our family, we just have not talked about any of these things. So as I, after this, my experience postpartum, I'm on a mission. I'm like, well, I can't be the only one. It has to be others. And so I start talking, and I went to my grandpa, and I found this book of poetry that my great-grandfather had written. And I thought, I didn't know what I would find. Anyway, I was reading this book, and in the middle of the book, I stumbled upon a section about illness and hospitals. It was this chapter of poetry. And I just couldn't believe, because he had a funny poem about staying in a Sheppard Pratt, which is a well-known psychiatric treatment center in Maryland, and I had no idea. And so I'm reading these poems about his experience, and then he goes on and he talks about his depression and how he felt in the hospital room and all. It was just so fascinating that this book had even been published within my family, but it hadn't been shared. I found it randomly on a shelf. Just very interesting. So after I finished reading all of the poems of my great grandfather, I went to my mom and I said, "Did you know that your grandpa had been admitted multiple times for mental breakdowns?" And my mom had no idea that this had ever happened. So I just kept finding more and more as I explored. I mean, and I in the end I have found, because since I've been so open and willing to talk about my experience, it kind of breaks the ice. So other people really, if they see, it seems that if you're open, other people are much more willing to be open. So then I find out almost every single one of my aunts, almost every single one of my cousins. There's this long line of not just typical sadness and anxiety. It's just this life-halting depression that's been in my family for years. And I always say, I'm not necessarily for everyone telling the whole world all your problems, and even though in my book I'm really open and I tell the world what I've gone through, I'm not for everyone going out there and telling these private things about themselves. But within a family unit, I think because there's shared genetics, and genetics does contribute to mental illness or in some mental illnesses, then it is a mistake to not be open within the family, because the more we learn about each other, if we learn about how someone else has suffered, we can learn how we can prevent it in our own lives. And then on top of that, I just think it's interesting that unlike our ancestors, who they did not live with the same medications that we have today, treatment is readily available for us today, so it's important to take advantage of it.
I think that there's this perception with all the research and attention that mental illness has received that, and maybe this goes back to some of the myths and misperceptions that, mm-hmm. that you know, why are so many more depressed people today than there were before, you know, or ADHD, mm-hmm. you know, you hear a lot about why are all these kids getting diagnosed with ADHD? And, mm-hmm. and again, it kind of goes back to some of that feeling that, well, they must just want to treat our kids, or they just want to make money off a pill, or, mm-hmm. and, you know, and I think that this very much has been the case with depression too. And especially because I think there's such a high percentage of, people being treated for depression in Utah. This comes up quite a bit, yes. I think, amongst Mormon circles. And so mm-hmm. I think that we forget that, you know, mental health is a fairly new, I guess, science or, you mm-hmm. know, study, and that we have more ability to diagnose than ever before. We, you know, so we're giving attention to things more than ever before. Mm-hmm. And so even though, like you're saying, you know, you can go back and kind of find these journals of your family that exist that kind of give you clues that these problems mm-hmm. didn't just start in your generation. But nobody was in a position to diagnose probably your great-grandfather mm-hmm. with clinical depression the way that we have that ability to do that mm-hmm. today. So do you agree that there's just an unexplainable rise in these mental health issues, or do you feel like it's more just we're more equipped to label and discern what it is that we're dealing with?
Oh, I completely agree with you. I even think, okay, so because my book comes from like my Christian paradigm, or because I'm a Latter-day Saint, I bring up the scripture Genesis 3:16. So ever since Eve cast out of the garden, God says, unto the woman he said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children. And I think from the very beginning of time, there has been mental illness, all the same mental illnesses that we have today. But, it has always been that way. But we did not know necessarily what was going on. And sometimes people didn't talk about it, or they explained it away as a devil, or, you know, like being possessed or something different. I mean, it's just always, I think it's always been there. And even with the same statistics, I really do. And women all throughout time, they've always experienced distress surrounding the menstruating or conception, pregnancy, giving birth to and raising children. I think what we've dealt with as mothers has always been that way. And postpartum, I think always it's been that 1 in 7 mothers has dealt with depression that first year of after the baby. And those statistics may even be low. I mean, I am maybe more of a believer that the statistics, even that with the stigma that surrounds mental illness and with the statistics that are even out there now, the statistics are all self-reported. And with this stigma, some people do not want to admit that they have a problem. And going forward, I even predict a rise of these statistics, but it doesn't mean all of a sudden we're just learning about depression and then people think they have it. It's just, I think it's always been there.
And I think even like you mentioned once, if you've been depressed since childhood or since adolescence, it may be so much your norm that you may not even know that you're depressed. Mm-hmm. Like there's this classification actually of depression called dysthymia, which means you're not maybe, you know, like suicidal or to the depths of hopelessness, but you're kind of in this lower category that you may not even recognize you're in a constant mm-hmm. depressive state because that's just what your life has been.
Yes.
So I think there's a lot of these issues, and I agree with your statement of probably it being underreported at this point still because of the stigmas. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, we're trying to get more research on that out all the time. There's also, I think, mm-hmm. Statistics will show that women suffer from depression more than men, but even that's being questioned right now because I think men suffer with depression somewhat differently than women do, so symptoms are somewhat different. And I think also the stigma for men to admit to depression is even worse than for women.
Most definitely. Yeah, they're supposed to be the strong ones, right?
Right. Okay, so the family history was important in the sense that once you started understanding that this wasn't just you, it started making more sense from a genetic standpoint, which we do know that depression and anxiety both have genetic dispositions. And I believe you also wrote, too, that you've been able to talk with siblings and almost mm-hmm. be a mentor as they're starting to go through some of their own issues. Thing.
Mm-hmm. So I have, I mean, like I talked about before, so many siblings, and with other sisters who have been pregnant, and well, my siblings also, it seems, have been their whole lives. I mean, I have siblings who have had children as well and have had some postpartum issues, but I see their lives and I say, yeah, I've been able to help them come sooner to getting help than I was able to by sharing my story. So I have one sister, I talk about three of my sisters in the book, and I don't name them or anything, but one sister, she self-medicated. So she's always dealt with these issues, but she went to the alcohol and went to the drugs and went to other, cigarettes have just had become her, I mean, it was a really unhealthy crutch, I guess, if you could call it, for her. But since then, she's gone to the therapy. She's visit therapist. She's now on Prozac, works for her really well. And now she was able to quit smoking because she does not need that same medication. I mean, she's getting in a more healthy way. And so I go throughout three of my sisters and just talk about their experience. And now, after our sisters have all dealt with it, then the boys have come out of the woodwork, and they were not all dealing with the same things. But like I talked about, my brother who is bipolar, it's been interesting that now that the girls have been willing to, then the boys have been suffering. We didn't realize as much before, but the same kind of anxiety is coming out. It's just a little different in the way they exhibit these symptoms.
I'm so glad to hear that your family is able to, you know, come together as a unit to deal with these things in an honest and open fashion. That's, I think, really wonderful.
Yeah, it's definitely a change. I mean, even 10 years ago, it was just not this way. So I think we've learned a lot as a family, and we're much more open, even across, I mean, outside, like with our aunts and uncles and extended family. It's just been a really helpful thing for our family to be more open. It's really saved some of us some unnecessary suffering.
Yeah, that's great. I'm a stickler for language, so I'm going to go back to something that you said, and so please forgive me. I just I have this, I don't know if it's a blessing or a curse, but I always think about, okay, how would somebody hear this if, you know, they were going through a certain situation? So
definitely.
You mentioned that when you lost Wyatt, you called that a blessing in disguise. And
yes.
I really want to honor that in the sense of, you know, you seeing it that way. At the same time, I know a lot of women in similar situations would not couch it in those terms. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to give you an opportunity to maybe explain what that means to you and also open up the possibility that not everybody has to see it that way.
Oh, definitely. No, I mean, it's not a wonderful thing to have happen to you, to lose your child. It's the worst thing that could have happened to you, that could happen to you. But for my child, for Wyatt, his body was not healthy. It just, the best thing for his body, it just, the body did what it was meant to do. And then I had to come to this acceptance of what death is about, and that our bodies and the spirit. And for me, I just came to, in the end, this acceptance that it's okay. His body wasn't working. It would not have done well. It just stopped working. So then it did what it was supposed to do. I mean, I don't know. See, I don't even know how to describe it. And that's a hard thing too. I came to an acceptance, and that's the way I kind of describe it. That I just understand that it's a blessing, even though it's a sad thing and it's in disguise because it's such a terrible thing for us and our family. It is probably the best thing for Wyatt. And that's just the way I think about it.
Yeah, I appreciate you expounding on that. I just wanted to, yeah, sometimes when we say things a certain way and then other people just misinterpret, and I think that you did a wonderful job explaining how you see that, so thank you.
Okay, well, we're kind of at the end of all the different things I wanted to talk to you about. What if you had a certain reading or excerpt that you'd like to share with us, what would that be from your book?
Yeah, I just thought even just the first chapter kind of just puts it out there. And I know it's a lot of the same that we've been talking about, but I'll just, the first few paragraphs, if you don't mind, I'll just start there.
Be great.
And I say, I take Prozac. There, I said it. I don't care who knows and if they know what they think, whether they think I'm crazy, less of a person, or unwise. How did I get to this point? That's exactly what I would like to share. Statistics show that in any given year, 1 out of 10 adults in the United States suffers from a mood disorder, and 1 in 5 suffers from an anxiety disorder. These figures are staggering. Although the current generation is much more open to taking medication for mental illness than in the past, there is still much work to be done because only half of those suffering from these types of disorders are receiving any type of treatment. I believe many more men and women may be struggling with depression and anxiety because these statistics are all self-reported. Many suffer in silence because of the still prevalent cultural stigma associated with getting help for mental illness, especially with taking medication for treatment. Even if reported statistics are correct, people who suffer from clinical depression or anxiety are often hesitant to talk openly about their experience. Getting necessary help should be a sign of good self-care. However, many believe that once they let someone know they need or have gotten help for a psychological disorder, they somehow lose credibility and become less valuable as an individual. In this book, I discuss my experience with clinical depression and anxiety and my faith-based journey to overcome the cultural stigma surrounding psychotropic medication. Knowing some will disagree with what I write, I put myself out as the proverbial sacrificial lamb. I want others to know they're not alone and to motivate them to get help and to get the help they need to live rational, balanced, and meaningful lives regardless of what others think.
Thank you so much for that. I really like how you pose it as a self-care issue, which I think as Mormons we can wrap our minds around very well. Do you want to speak a little bit about, you know, this is a Mormon audience. We are talking with more than anything else, probably. And although we welcome non-Mormons to listen, obviously, but
definitely.
What would you say, you know, in our Mormon culture, how do you see some of these stigmas and what do you see as far as like the benefits and the cons of being a Mormon when it comes to dealing with depression? Because I think that there's value in discussing both.
I think there is an idea in the LDS Church that, I mean, we have this scripture, like I talked about before, wickedness never was happiness. So we look at someone else's life and we say, okay, they're not happy, they must be doing something wrong, or they're not following this commandment or that commandment. And all of us are trying to align ourselves with these truths that when it's not working, then we put the blame on, we think it's sin of some sort. And there are some myths that are perpetuated within the culture, even though if you go to the main website of the church and and there are quite a few resources for people with mental illness. But I say wickedness never was happiness, but I say mental illness never was happiness. Just because wickedness never was happiness doesn't mean other things cannot also contribute to that. And so within one article I found that was fascinating was by a member of the 70, Elder Alexander B. Morrison. And he goes through, and you can find this online at LDS.org, but he goes through the myths and misconceptions we have, and the very first one he hits on is all mental illness is caused by sin. He says that's a myth. And it's not definitely sin, or the deliberate breaking of God's commandments does result in behavior that hurts ourselves and hurts others, and we can become sad around that. But it's mental illness does not, it's not a perfect correlation. It's not, the truth is that many faithful Latter-day Saints who live the commandments and honor covenants and do everything that they should, they still experience these struggles with mental illness, whether it be depression, anxiety, or anything else. And the families that surround them are all affected. And when we are looking at this within the church, these are some of the least, I mean, these, the people who need our help and love and compassion the most are the ones that we sometimes find, and I was this way before, I mean, find ourselves judging, and when really those are the ones that need our help the most, they're really struggling. But it's just, so within the church, we just have to take a step back and say, okay, what myths do I believe, or what am I perpetuating? I mean, and it's been interesting, even within my ward, the first month I came out with the book, I mean, people were really quiet about it, and they didn't, only people would come and talk to me about it behind the scenes, and when the Relief Society, they sent out an email and said, hey, Becca's written this book, you should check it out. And I would only get people just quietly emailing or quietly behind the scenes coming to my door so no one else really can see them approach me even at church and say, well, I know I've dealt with this my whole life and this is what I've done for that. But even just within a month or two, it's been 2 months since I put the book out opened it up to just my individual ward. And just within a couple months, I've seen this interesting change to where the first month I go to the Relief Society meeting, no one dares talk to me. I mean, it's behind the scenes. Only someone will catch me when no one's around in the hallway. And then this next month, we're sitting around a quilt, and there's quite a few of us. And then it just becomes the topic of conversation, which was really helpful because then a lot of women, once it was okay to talk about, it was surprising the people who were dealing with it. And then they talk about their children. And if we can be open about it within our church, if we can be open, we can get help. And it's just with the what I love from the gospel is with the self-reliance whole thought, because we believe in, as LDS people, that we should be self-reliant. I mean, but we have this atonement where there's not one of us on the earth who doesn't need help in some way. I mean, especially through, I mean, we all need Christ to be saved through his infinite atonement for our sins. And I love the analogy of the brass serpent that Moses lifted up in the wilderness and as recorded in the Old Testament. Unless the Israelites would look up after being bitten by these fiery serpents, they would die. Unless they would accept help, they would die. If they didn't acknowledge the problem, they would die. And it kind of symbolizes the role, it does symbolize the role of our Savior. And to where getting help is a sign of good self-care. And the error lies with not getting help when we need it. And then that's what I take on to the mental illness. I mean, it's important to get help when we need it. I mean, and so it's been interesting within the church to talk about it because there are some myths that aren't coming, I mean, they're not official. I mean, but I've loved to see that the LDS Church also, I mean, even on their website, there's resources, there's articles, so much more can be done. But it's just important to take an inventory of some of the things that you believe about mental illness and think about it. And I don't blame anyone who holds a stigma for mental illness because I just say to myself, they obviously have not dealt with it like I have, or they obviously have not had it in their family, or they obviously have not, and I don't wish that on anyone, but the more educated we are about what mental illness really is, and the more we can understand it, the better we can help within our community. So we're all divided in these wards and stakes, the more we can reach out with love and compassion and help other people. So that's how I kind of see it going through, and I'm just trying to do my small part and just demystifying postpartum depression and some of these other mental illnesses that we have. And I feel like I'm a great person and a successful person, and I try to do everything as best I can. I mean, I'm not perfect, and someone could easily look into my life and dissect it and say, I mean, yeah, I have a lot I can improve on. But it's okay to struggle with these things, but it's not okay to not get help. I mean, we need to get help, and there's a lot we can do to support each other within the church and within our, I mean, just the culture at large. if the more we learn about it, the more we can help. So
I know that's really great. I often say that, you know, in our Mormon culture, we're a group of doers and workers, right? We're bees mm-hmm. in the beehive.
Oh,
and we take a lot of, I think, there's a lot
take
of
too much on, I think.
Sometimes, yeah. And I think there's this identity that has very much to do with the scripture, you know, that says, you know, we're saved after all we can do. And
yes.
And in fact, we get criticized by other Christians for that, you know, like we're downplaying the atonement of Christ or something. But I think as Mormons, we would look at that differently. At the same time, I think there is a certain discomfort with grace in our Mormon culture. And I think that's very much what you're talking about, is accepting, yes, you know, being a worker, trying your best. Those are all important principles. And those are wonderful things that I think many Mormons are good at. At the same time, there's that needing to accept grace, needing to accept, I'm not always going to be able to do things on my own. And in fact, it goes right into one of our main principles, which is to bear each other's burdens. But how do we bear
yes.
each other's burdens if we're silent about them, right? And we don't
yeah.
even know what we're bearing. So it's, we're very good at casserole bringing, you know, when something has obviously happened, you know, there's a death in the family or there's a birth mm-hmm. in the family or things that you don't really hide from one another. but we're not so great as far as the emotional casseroles when these things that are dealt with more in private.
Yes.
And to your point, some things are private and some things you don't
Definitely.
Want to share with other people. At the same time, it sounds to me like you're having an experience similar within your family of origin with your ward family, that the more you're open about it, the more conversation there is and the more mm-hmm. Ability there is to open up about certain struggles within a sisterhood and the Relief Society.
Yeah, and even outside of that, I mean, with just putting the book out there too, within the ward, I mean, I had a 75 or just an older gentleman who was on Prozac for years, and he has felt the shame, like getting help for his situation is a bad thing. And after he reads this book, then it, in front of, like, as I sent out the message or a group post or whatever and said, hey, check out the book, this is what I'm kind of talking about. And he responds to everyone and says, now I do not feel ashamed to take Prozac. Now, it's if you are doing the best for you, then that's okay. And with accepting grace, to going back to your point with that, if we can come from that standpoint and accept the help and accept the grace and accept God, we can do so much more. And so it's counteractive to say, yeah, we want to be this worker bee. I mean, we want to do everything good, but the more we accept, I mean, we can do everything through God who strengthens us. So if we can accept Him and accept help where we need it, then we can do so much more.
Well, so you've touched on this a little bit, but what has been your overall response then to having published this and come out? Have you had, obviously you've had some positive responses. Have you had any negative responses? Or,
you know, I expected a lot more negative, but I've had quite a bit of positive. It's been like freeing for some other people. But I have had one person responded and said, I can't support your book because this is wrong. She comes from a naturalist kind of standpoint and believes like almost that taking a medication is like breaking the word of wisdom, she kind of talked about, and how it's not healthy for our bodies. And it was interesting seeing that point of view, but that is very small. It seems like so many of us are affected by mental illness all throughout the church. Well, the world, I mean, we're just not excluded. Everyone, that most of the response has been positive, where it's all, I have just been surprised how positive. I mean, I got one person wrote me, I don't know who they are, and wrote me on, sent me a message on Facebook and says, I really felt so much support through your book, more than I felt in the past from any family member or any friend. But then she can take this book and share it with her family members, and it kind of gives other people an idea. I mean, someone who deals with depression and anxiety is not just crazy. They're just trying to do the best they can, and they've happened upon this struggle. And I had another lady in my ward say, she says she struggled her whole life with bipolar, with this manic depressive disorder, and she said after she was done reading, she told her husband and her daughter, if you want to understand me a little bit more, this book is really could help. And so it's actually the book combined with the conversation, it's been a really, what I've seen most of all, is it's just a really good conversation starter. It kind of breaks the ice to where we can open up and talk about things that everyone is dealing, a lot of people are dealing with. And I've just been surprised by the positive response. It's mostly been all positive. I really have been surprised. So it's almost like the stigma I thought existed may not exist as much as I thought, or the fears I had about it. I think it's changing. I think it's a positive. I think it's all positive. I think the stigma is lessening for sure.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I kind of got that sense too, that you were kind of posing yourself for, you know, like preparing yourself for a backlash or something, and then it hasn't been forthcoming, and that's really wonderful.
I've been surprised. Yeah, I didn't realize.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had a little, but not much at all. Really, people are just kind and supportive, so.
Well, and I'm pretty comfortable with the word everyone, because with the statistics of depression, even though you may not deal with it yourself, the likelihood of you knowing a friend or a family member who's going through, depression,
that's,
I think,
true,
is pretty, monumentally possible. So,
that's true.
So I do think that this is a good read from a perspective either of it, being yourself or trying to understand, somebody you may know that, and it's difficult oftentimes when you're a loved one of somebody who's depressed, when you're wanting to help, you have, very much concern for a person who is struggling and oftentimes not knowing what to do, to be able to reach out or be helpful. And so that's a very frustrating position I know that loved ones can find themselves in.
Definitely.
For sure. So, well, what's next for you? What are you planning on focusing next on, or do you have any plans for the future as far as this is concerned? Or
So I'm just going to keep trying to get my book out there and share it, and I'll work on that probably for another year, I'm thinking. But then after that, I really like the idea of creating there, since it's not just the LDS faith who has some of these myths, it's a lot of faiths, and so there's an interesting religious culture sometimes. Anyway, so going forward, that's all a jumble. So going forward, though, my plan is to do an interfaith, book of struggles and of just discussing mental illness across all sorts of different faiths, and also men and women, and just to open it up and to say, and I want it to be a success stories, and I just want to dwell on that there's a lot of good being done, and there's a lot of help out there if you'll seek it.
I wish you the best with all that you do, and I want to thank you again for coming on and sharing with us your experience and your thoughts. And
thank you.
I hope this is helpful in getting your book out there. And for those who are listening, I would just encourage you to, through comments or whatever, share your thoughts and experiences and feedback for both I and Becca. And if you see it in your possibilities to donate monetarily to Mormon Mental Health, that's also very helpful. And with that, I'll say goodnight.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Mental Health. To discuss this episode, please check us out at mormonmentalhealth.org. To keep the podcast alive, please consider a donation today, again, at mormonmentalhealth.org. Logo was provided by Daniel Singer. Music was generously donated by Lower Lights. Please check them out at thelowerlights.com. And thanks for listening.
Over last tempestuous sea, chart and compass came from thee. Jesus saved.